Good evening. My name is Eileen, and I'm an alcoholic.
Eileen.
It's a privilege to speak here. I want to thank Tim for asking me to come and share. I have many friends in this room, for which I'm grateful. I brought two of my own as well. Well, I will just tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I was born, as many of you were, 47 plus years ago in Boise, Idaho, which is a boring anecdote. Who just hissed Boise, Idaho? Oh, now you're all going to hiss. Okay. It would be a boring anecdote, except that my parents are Jewish people from the Bronx, and they weren't just passing through. They lived there for 10 years. Their names are Harry and Harriet. They're a set. And they really do exist, and for those of you who are going to be at the Midnight Mission dinner next week, I will be coming there with them, and so you'll have an opportunity to meet Harry and Harriet. The reason why they're coming is because my father, for those of you who don't know, has a long-standing relationship with Clancy. My father was the account executive of the Kamchatka vodka account at Weinberg Advertising when Clancy was drunk and worked in the mailroom. And, true story. I missed that and I'm sorry. I'm sure someone will tell me later what Clancy said. He wanted to give suggestions to my father about how he should describe the product, but was instructed by his sponsor that not everybody had the same reaction to vodka that Clancy had, and in fact, I had, and my father didn't have. Anyway, so we will be there next week, and you can verify that story with my dad. Anyhow, so I was born in Boise, Idaho. When I was 4 years old, we moved to California. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, where I was the star of my grammar school, which was the last time I achieved greatness. I'm one of those people who peaked early, like 11 and a half, and then it was downhill from there. But when I was in grammar school, I was ahead of everything. I was the teacher's pet, the nurse's pet, the principal's pet. I was the butt kisser is what I was. And I was also a very neurotic and very weird child, and I was self-involved to the extreme. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we call it self-obsession. I was a very self-conscious child. I was very concerned about how I was impacting the planet. I was very concerned about what you thought about me. I've recently come up with an analogy for how I was as a child and how I became later. I don't have any pets of my own, but I work for a man that I've worked for 11 years, and I work in his home. And he has a dog and two cats, and I've been able to see sort of the contrasting behavior of these two species. The dog is a Labrador Retriever. His name is Roger. Roger likes a lot of approval. And, you know, and the way that I picture Labrador Retrievers talking is that they come around you and they go, "How am I doing? How am I doing? Am I okay? Am I okay? Hey, see that big treat jar up on the shelf? I really like those big beef sticks. Could I have one of those? Hey, could I? Yeah, that's really good. Thanks." And you say, "Hey, Roger, you're great. Go lay down. Have your beef stick. Have a good time." And he's back 5 minutes later. "How am I doing now? Am I okay now? Huh? Huh? That beef stick was really terrific. Do you think I could have another one of those?" Whereas cats, who are my house pet of choice, and I know that they've asked me not to use profane language, but they didn't say anything about profane gestures, cats walk around like this, okay? You know how cats walk around? You know, and... So basically, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a dog. As I grew older and weirder, I wanted to be a cat. I never became a cat, which meant that I was a dog who basically walked around in cat's clothing, you know. Which meant that I desperately cared what you thought about me, but I walked around like this. Anyway, I heard a woman describe how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. She described it perfectly. She said, "I came into AA like this. Help me. Stay as far away from me as possible, but please help me." And that's how I walked in, because I was terrified and I didn't want you near me. But anyway, I started to drink when I was 12. And it was none too soon, believe me. And I don't recall having a great epiphany when I started to drink, but I certainly started to drink as much as I could, as often as I could from that time on. I believe it was Charlie Carney who said that he never crossed any invisible line but his lips. And I identified with that, you know. I mean, that was the only invisible line I ever crossed, because I never had any interest in social drinking from the, you know, from the gate. But when you're 12, you don't go to like a lot of cocktail parties and drink martinis, you know. I go to this little gym in West Hollywood, and I think the street people sort of use this alley where we walk through to come from the parking lot. And I saw, God, I got so nostalgic. I saw a bottle, an empty bottle, of course, of Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill, there in the alley. You know, I'm your basic Boone's Farm, Ripple, Thunderbird, Red Mountain kind of gal. You know, I'm a screw top gal, okay, basically. You know, I like those screw tops. And later on, you know, I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but let's face it, the first speaker talked about drugs. I grew up during the 60s. It's what we did, you know. But I'm an alcoholic, but I used anything. As a friend of mine says, my drug of choice was, what do you have? You know, and I'm like, take now, ask questions later. But basically, if you want to get a beat on me, I'm your basic Ripple and Reds kind of gal, okay? I like to drink cheap wine. I like to take medication intended for sleep. I like to sit in the corner and drool. And when I'm not doing that, if I can crawl to it, I'm operating a motor vehicle. And you're sorry. I drank and used for a total of 12 years. It was not pretty. It was not big. It was not spectacular. I mean, I remember when I was new and people would get up here and they would say things like, I took a drink and I ended up in Bangkok. And I would think, God, I wish I'd end up anywhere, you know. But when you drink and take a lot of downers, you don't go too far. So it was 12 years for me, like I said, nothing big and spectacular happened, you know, and I don't think that most alcoholics, you know, have really spectacular lives. I think that they have little pathetic lives, and sometimes they go on and on for a lot of years. You know, I was very fortunate, because I got sober when I was 24, unlike my aunt, my father's sister, who drank till she was about 75 and then killed herself. I think that's the kind of lives that alcoholics have. You know, this was my father's sister. My father's mother died when he was 10, and all of his siblings were a lot older than he. And this particular sister had taken the place of his mother. She lived in Mount Vernon, New York, and none of us really knew how much she drank until my father and his then two remaining brothers moved her out here after her husband died. And then we began to find out the extent of this. And she lived in one of those little alcoholic apartments up on Hollywood Boulevard, you know. And I happened to be on my way to Cubby Selby's 15th AA birthday party when my dad got the call that she had succeeded after four other unsuccessful attempts. And she wasn't fooling any of those times. They would break down the door. And I got to take the ride into Hollywood with my dad, you know, my sweet, sweet dad. My dad is the sweetest man in the world. And go into the, apartment there with the coroner and the police and everything. And it was one of those apartments with one suit hanging in the closet and cheap towel hanging on the rack and overflowing ashtrays and half-empty bottles of whiskey and beer cans everywhere. And my father standing in the middle of the room crying and saying, look at this shit, look at all that's left out of 75 years of life. But that would have been a sad enough end of the story, except when they settled the will out of probate. My father, who got far less than his two other brothers, who were much needier, got $80,000. She did not need to live that way. And that's how I think alcoholics end up. But I'm one of the fortunate ones, because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was young. And I did enough that I had to do to get here. I was one of those people, you know, who, I was around and nobody really wanted me around very much. You know, I was too loud and I laughed at all the wrong places and I crawled around on the floor and I slept with whoever happened to be handy. I was pathetic and overbearing and disgusting. There was nothing about my drinking that was attractive or beautiful or gay or anything like that. It was just ugly and petty and little and small and pathetic. Anyway, it got worse and worse, and I didn't really know that it was getting worse and worse, because for me, you know, there are some people who drink to get into life, and there are people who drink to get out of life, and I'm one of those people who drank to get out of life, and I don't really know what it was about my life that was so painful that I had to drink to get out of it, but I never found living in reality very easy. You know, and I still only have sort of a rapprochement with reality, and I have it because Alcoholics Anonymous enables me to live in the world in a way that I find comfortable. But anyway, I never found, you know, living on this planet easy. As a friend of mine used to say, you know, that she had felt like she'd been jettisoned to Earth without the brochure. You know, and it seemed like everybody else knew how to live life, but I didn't have a clue, you know. And I always like when speakers get up here at the lectern in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said lectern because Bill LaValle insists it's a lectern. Anyway, but he's right. Anyway, they get up and they say in some folksy way, even if they're from New York, you know, the longer I'm sober, the less I know. And I always want to sit there and say, God, haven't you been paying attention? They have a lot of good information here, you know. I mean, I got here, I was clueless, you know. I mean, everything that I know about living in the world, I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And anyway, I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 1974. It was July or August, I'm not sure. And God, I loved when, what was her name? Barbara, am I right? My mind is gone. The second speaker was talking about Schlibovitz. I don't know if any of you even know what Schlibovitz is. It's like Eastern European whiskey. And anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. Except that I've drank it. And it'll knock you on your keister. Anyhow, I came in July or August of 1974. There were not a lot of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1974. You know, there were not a lot of attractive young people like I see in this room and in other rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of the most unattractive of the unattractive young people. Much of it had to do with how I looked. I weighed 230 attractive pounds. I was wearing a $5.99 granny dress from Zodi's and a pair of Zoris. Shoelaces had become too difficult. My hygiene was questionable. I had a haircut that I believe I had performed on myself. And I had a very hostile attitude. Now, I'm not of the belief that you should come to Alcoholics Anonymous with a good attitude. I mean, why would you, you know? Life had been crappy for me for a long time, and I didn't see how coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was going to change any of that. And I stuck around for about 5 months with that attitude, and you know, and people tried to reach me, but I wouldn't let anybody near me. And I never call that period of time that 5 months slipping. It wasn't slipping. I was drinking for 5 months, and every once in a while, maybe I'd get a day or so. But I went to meetings in Hollywood, which were just fine. There was nothing wrong with the meetings in Hollywood. I leaned against walls. I glared at people. I dared them to come near me. Most of them didn't. There were a couple of really mean old guys in AA who seemed to like me. One of them was named Irving Neamey. He's dead now. He was an old longshoreman. And Irving used to get up here and he'd put the microphone aside and he'd say, I don't need this thing. And you'd think, I guess you don't, Irv. And anyway, he was very kind. He was very gruff on the outside, but he was very kind and he liked me. And he talked to me and another guy talked to me. But when the holidays rolled around in 1974, I thought, you're not sober anyway. There would be no point in sticking around this outfit. And I left. I had some vague plan to come back after the first of the year, but my birthday is March 3rd, so it took me 2 months longer than I thought it was going to take me. But then again, things rarely ever worked out the way that I, you know, thought they would. I mean, one of the things that I love the most about being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is that my word means something today. You know, when I got here, you know, people talk about profanity, you know, and they put these signs up sometimes, like at the Marina Center, there's a sign that says no profane or vulgar language, and I rarely ever swear anymore. But that really makes me want to swear like a sailor. I don't know what it is about me, you know. I just don't like people telling me what to do. You know, you tell me I can't do something, I want to do it. You know, a couple of years ago, I was up in Sacramento speaking at the Spring Fling Roundup or something, and anyway, they had this cake the size of a football field in the back of the room, and I swear there was a sign next to the thing that said, don't molest the cake. Well, you know, it made me want to do a snow angel in the cake, you know what I'm saying? I just wanted to fling myself on top of the cake, but I don't do things like that anymore. Anyway, you know, but the words that were dirty when I got here were words like job, commitment, responsibility, you know. I have a friend who's sober a year longer than I, and she had some very interesting answers to the 20 questions. Is drinking affecting your job? What job? Is drinking affecting your home life? What home? And my personal favorite, is drinking affecting your reputation? To which she responded, drinking is my reputation. And You know, growing up in the 60s and having idols who were all like dead rock stars, you know, like Janis Joplin and such, you know, I mean, that was my reputation too, you know. I mean, I was proud of the fact that I could drink guys much bigger than me under the table. This made me really happy. I don't think it would make me happy today, but it made me happy then. And anyway, I came back on March 3rd of 1975, and I had no idea that I would still be sober to this day. But I was very fortunate because somebody intervened on my behalf. The man who became my first sponsor saw me the following day at the Radford Clubhouse in North Hollywood. And he backed me up against the wall. He'd seen me around in 74, and he said to me, "Look, punk," he said, "you have a serious problem with alcohol and drugs, and you better damn well get sober or you're going to die." And then he backed it up by saying, "And if you don't get sober, I'm going to break your jaw." Now, I don't know what you would have thought. I thought, he cares. And then I wanted to know why. Because if you were like me and you came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if somebody did something nice for you, it's because they wanted something. And if you did something nice for somebody, it's because you wanted something. And I knew that people weren't being nice to me because they wanted something from me, because by the time I came crawling back into Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I had nothing to offer. Nothing. And I took his telephone number. What a miracle that is. I took his telephone number and I called him. Miracle number one. Miracle number two, I called him a second time, because the first time, completely without my permission, he started telling me what to do. Now, I told you, I don't like people telling me what to do. And what he told me to do was that I had to go to 7 to 9 meetings a week. I had to sit in the front row. I had to be responsible for my chair and my ashtray. I had to thank speakers, whether I thought they had anything to say or not. I had to get a big book. I had to get a meeting commitment, and I was essentially useless, but I had a car, and I could drive other people to meetings. Now, I want to tell you how much I welcomed this suggestion. I did not. But like you, I did everything I was told to do. I may have mumbled bad two-part words beginning with mother under my breath, but I did what I was told to do because I didn't want to go back to where I was just coming from. My first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous was shaking hands at the door of a meeting that I'm sure some of you remember called Wilshire Normandy. Wilshire Normandy was a big Sunday night meeting in town 23 years ago, and the reason why it was called that is because it was on the corner of Wilshire and Normandy, because they're so brilliant here. And a friend of mine gave me a meeting directory from 1966. I went looking through it to find, like, my favorite meeting name. I found it. The No Donut Group in Pomona, you know? You can just picture these old farts sitting around going, "We're not going to have our meeting adulterated by pastry, you know, and as a matter of fact, we're not even going to have any coffee, you know, I mean, anything not to dilute the message." Anyway, don't ask me. I'm sure somebody was there, probably Clance. Were you ever there, Clance? They give you a donut? Probably not. Anyway, so that was my commitment, and because I came to AA with no life, which is a really good way to come to AA, because then you have nothing to do but go to meetings, I would get there an hour and a half early, because I had a particular place where I liked to stand by the door. And I would put my keys on the floor to hold my place, and God help you if you stood there or moved my keys, because it was my place. It was my place. And you know, and then people started recognizing me in the other meetings that I went to. I mean, I'm sure they thought, "Oh, my God, the bitch from, you know, Wilshire." Because, you know, I was a hostel greeter. You know, you came to Wilshire, you got it greeted whether you wanted to be or not, you know. And we made you. And I think Peter was in charge then, and some other types, you know, who really were strict. Anyway, I started getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. The man who helped me became my first sponsor. He became my sponsor after about a month. I called him up one day on the phone, and I screamed at him, "Are you my sponsor or what?" And he said to me, "I guess I am," and then he tried to get rid of me for the next 5 years. He never wanted to sponsor me. And finally, when I was eight and a half years sober, I got my present sponsor, Julie C., who is a marvelous woman. And the reason why she is my sponsor is because she has 36 years of sobriety. She's still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's a forthright and honest person. She still helps others. And she has what I want. About 4 years ago, she moved to a little town up above Fraser Park called Pine Mountain Club. I know you've all heard of it. They have 3 meetings a week there. The last time I was at the big Saturday night meeting, there were 10 of us, and 4 of us were from out of town.
And, you know, she's integrated herself into that little community and then comes down to town for the rest of her meetings. But, you know, she's the one for me. You know, she's the one for me. And I hope, you know, I heard the lady talk about Pat, and I'm sorry to hear that she's sick. I hope that everyone feels about their sponsor the way that I feel about mine. You know, in the way that I still feel about that first sponsor, because, I don't know, you know, when I turned 20 years sober, I reflected on something the morning of my 20th birthday, and I started thinking about, you know, what a miracle it was that this one person in Alcoholics Anonymous had taken 5 seconds out of his life to take an interest in my case and to tell me the truth. And because of that, my life started here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And then what a miracle it is that we take phone numbers of people and we start calling them and we start telling them things about ourselves that we swore we would never tell another person. And I believe that's because Alcoholics Anonymous is based on the concept of one drunk talking to another. You know, I was in tons of therapy before I came to AA, and I'm not here to knock therapy. However, I was in tons of it before I came here, and, you know, there were 4 basic fundamental reasons why therapy did not work for me. Number one, I never trusted the therapist, so I always lied to them. And it's hard to get any help if you're not telling the truth. Number two, I always had the feeling they didn't know what I was talking about, which may or may not be true. It doesn't really matter. Number three, even though I was paying them, I felt it was my obligation to entertain them, and I was pretty good at it. But number four, and most importantly, looking back now in retrospect, I think what they were trying to do is get me happy enough to stop killing myself. The only problem is I am by nature a miserable malcontent and a chronic depressive, you know? And if you wait for somebody like me to get happy enough, generally I will kill myself first. Alcoholics Anonymous takes the opposite approach. Alcoholics Anonymous says stop killing yourself first. We will worry about the reasons later. The most amazing thing about this organization and about the way we recover in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you don't have to know anything about why you drank in order to stop drinking. The way you stop drinking is you stop drinking. That's how you stop drinking. The way you stay stopped is by working the steps and getting down to the causes and conditions. But initially, you don't have to know anything, which was perfect for me because I was always trying to unravel the mystery of me, you know, because I'm so smart. It's a good thing that Alcoholics Anonymous is not an intellectual pursuit, because if it were, I would have read that book, been out of here in a couple of weeks, you know what I mean? I would have just crammed for the test, learned everything I needed to know, and be out of here. But AA doesn't work that way. AA, I have come to believe for myself, is a spiritual practice. You know, a spiritual practice, which means that if you are a practicing Christian, Catholic, Buddhist, Jew, Hindu, whatever, you know, Muslim, whatever your religious faith might be or not, whatever, it requires certain practice that you do every single day in order to stay on your spiritual path. That's the same thing Alcoholics Anonymous requires. It requires action taken every single day to stay on the spiritual path. I'm one of the lucky ones. I came in here and I immediately found out that I belonged here, whether I wanted to be here or not, and that I was never going to be able to labor under the illusion that I did not need this program. And because of that, I have been an active member the entire time that I have been sober. I've never taken a hiatus. I've never taken a break. I have always been an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I need to be and because today I want to be. You know, I'm not an altruist. I'm not the nicest person I've ever met. I'm no Pollyanna. I'm not perky. I don't even like the word. You know what I mean? But as a result of doing the spiritual practice of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have become a positive person in spite of myself. I have learned a different way to view life. I have had a spiritual experience, the likes of which they talk about in the appendix in the back of the book called The Spiritual Experience. Essentially, in those pages, what they're talking about is I've had a change of attitude. I'll tell you a little story. My mantra these days is, it's not Mary. That's my mantra, it's not Mary, and I will explain to you what that means. About a year and a half ago, a friend of mine and I had the opportunity to go to Italy. Now, by the way, I think the only reason on earth to have money is to travel and get a lot of massages. That's what I think, you know? I think that you should just get on airplanes and go anywhere, you know? And anyway, we had this opportunity to go to Italy, and I had a cold. But I have to tell you, I'm grumpy anyway, but I was really grumpy after being 14 hours in a metal tube with a cold. And we land in the airport in Rome. We change planes in London. We land in the airport in Rome, and the baggage comes down, and it turns out my friend's suitcase is there and mine isn't. I immediately decide God likes her better because she's a vegetarian and she runs. She must be a better person. And we get into line at the lost and found. And by now, I'm weeping. I'm thinking, my God, where am I going to get clothes in Italy? You know, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And all of a sudden, this thought pops into my mind. It's not Mary. And Mary is a friend of mine that I got sober with. And last year, hepatitis C had so destroyed her liver as a result of her drinking and using prior to coming to AA that she had to have a transplant. And when Gail and I left the United States, Mary was laying in intensive care. She'd had a bad reaction to the anti-rejection drugs. And she was very ill, and we didn't know if she was going to live or die. And she's fine now, by the way, thank God. But we didn't know if she was going to live or die when we left the country. And I'm standing in line, and I'm getting all weepy about my suitcase, and all of a sudden I thought, Eileen, it is a suitcase. It's not Mary. So my mantra has become, it's not Mary. And then we went to my friend Peter's apartment, which turned out to be this penthouse two blocks from the Spanish Steps, not bad. And because Peter's Italian, he called the airport and spoke to them in Italian. You know those Italians, they're very gifted. And that way, even the kids and dogs speak Italian in Italy. It's amazing. Anyway, he called them, and by midnight the suitcase was at the door, and I had a whole new perspective, you know, which I'd pretty much been able to hold on to today. You know, it's not Mary. Whatever it is, it's not a big deal. It's not Mary. And as I said, you know, traveling has become a huge part of my life. I really started to travel when I was 10 years sober. And, you know, I've been all kinds of places. You know, I've been to France, and I've been to Italy, and I've been to Hawaii a couple of times, and I've been to Canada, and I've been all over this country, and I've been to Mexico. I've been to Jamaica. You know, I love reggae music, and people said to me, my God, how can you go to Jamaica and not smoke dope? I said, excuse me, how can I live in Los Angeles and not smoke dope? You know, I was relaxed in Jamaica. I have the pictures to prove it. Anyway, but by far the most interesting trip I took was in 1987. I went to Israel for 6 weeks to work on a movie, and I was there, and I got to tell you, Israel's a very challenging country. You know, they don't have, let me just say this. Here are the meetings I got. On Wednesday, I went to a women's stag. We were lucky. We had four. I went to visit some bizarre loners out on the West Bank with guns. And I went to NA meetings in a bomb shelter in Tel Aviv because that was what was available. And in the NA meetings, just about everybody speaks Hebrew because, you know, where you learned it is in high school or the army, and the junkies don't have time to go. And one night I gave a talk. It was translated from English into Hebrew by a native German-speaking girl. I don't have any idea what they heard, but about 6 years ago, my telephone rang at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, and I picked up the phone, and it was this guy. I'll never forget this. He says, hi. This is Othniel. I met you in Israel. I'm in Spring Valley, New York. Do you know where there's an NA meeting? And I'm like, I don't even know where Spring Valley, New York is. But I thought, I'll try and help you. And he spoke very little English, but I called Narcotics Anonymous in New York City. I hope all of you have this experience someday. Guy answers the phone. He goes, hi, I'm Joey. I'm an addict. And I think, who isn't? Shut up, you know. And I explained Avner's predicament, and he promised to call Avner, and so I figured, whatever. And right before I went, I had a crisis whose name I can't currently remember, so if you're having one of those, it'll pass. And I called my sponsor, who was somewhere, and so then I called my first sponsor. I hadn't talked to him about 3 years, and he laughed, and he said he had to give me the names of these people who lived in Israel that he had met in Hawaii, and they were in the program. And I got over there, and I called this woman whose name was Nancy. And I told her who I was, and she said, I know who you are. And I said, how do you know who I am? And she said, about a month ago, somebody from the state sent me a bunch of AA tapes, and one of them was yours. Anyway, she saved my butt while I was there. Because it was hard to be there. The meetings weren't what I was used to. I mean, we are so spoiled in Southern California. Let's face it. There are more people in this room than there are in AA in some little towns around this country, you know. And I always love when people come to me and say, I can't find a meeting I like, you know. And so I get out the meeting directory, you know, the novelette over there, and I tell them I'd like them to go to every single meeting in that directory and then come back and tell me they can't find a meeting they like because I've done the simple mathematics. It'll take 7 years, and you'll get rid of the whiner. Anyway, While I was in Israel, I went to Egypt. Why? Because you can. And I spent two fun-filled days in Egypt riding around in an un-air-conditioned Fiat. Egypt is a country where you feel loaded even when you're not. There are no lanes in Cairo. There's only 5 traffic signals. I think they're ornamental. They're guarded by guys in clean white uniforms with epaulets. They have camels and donkeys and water buffalo and stuff all over. It's like being on a funhouse ride from hell, basically. And anyway, by the end of the second day, I'm half dead. I'm reclining in the Perfume Palace in Giza. I've just ridden a camel. I mean, I'm somebody who couldn't get off the floor, and now I'm riding a camel. And I'm half dead, and I'm 12 and a half years sober. A guy I've never seen before in my life walks up to me, and he says, "I can get you some hashish." I think I'm in Egypt. Who would know? And then I thought, you had better get your butt back to that bomb shelter, even if you don't understand anything they're saying, because the disease never sleeps. I go to meetings for 4 basic fundamental reasons. Number 1, I need them. Number 2, I like them. You know, I've become a fairly interesting person in the last 23 years. I can go to a non-AA party and never even once mention all night that I'm a member of AA. But the people that I am closest to, the people who are my dear friends, are all members of AA, like my friends Harvey and Patty, who came here with me tonight, who feel as passionately about Alcoholics Anonymous as I do, as do my friends in this room tonight. It is important to be on the same path with the people that you are close to, I believe. Number 3 is my sponsor, Julie C., the Great White Goddess, says that's where they keep the newcomers. I have never felt that the point of AA is to get yours and split. The point of AA is to get yours and give it back to somebody else as it was given to you. And number 4, and more compelling than ever, is that most of the time I do not look like an alcoholic, I don't act like an alcoholic, and I need to come to meetings to remember that the only reason why I look the way I look, feel the way I feel, have the job that I have today, the car that I have today, the apartment I have today, the friends that I have today, the life that I have today, the relationship with my family that I have today, my sobriety, my higher power, is because I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for no other reason. There is no other reason why I have the life that I have today. Now, I want to tell you, because I have 5 minutes, which is just enough time to talk about the big event of 1996, 97, and 98, the ongoing adventure. If at any time you think you're going to get your life in a nice little neat package, forget it, because God has a way of sending celestial monkey wrenches into the mix just to make sure you're paying attention. I got a whopper. On July 4th, 1996, I was sitting on my couch. I was staring out the window, drinking a cup of coffee, thinking, man, I'm going to have 4 days off of work. This is good. Thinking eventually I'd get off my butt, go to the store, get the stuff for the salad I committed to bringing to a party later that afternoon, and my telephone rang. And it was a woman. I didn't know who she was. She said, "My name is Julie Jones, and I'm a private search investigator from Seattle, Washington, and I've been asked to locate you." And I didn't know why she was calling. And then she said, "Is your name Eileen Waterstone?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Does the date March 28, 1969 mean anything to you?" And then I knew. Because on March 28, 1969, I gave birth to a son that I gave up for adoption. And I signed him away when he was 3 days old. I had made the decision based on conversations that I'd had with people on all sides of the birth triangle over the years that I had been sober that I was not going to search, that it would be a violation of his privacy and that of the people who adopted him, but there it was. And I started to cry, and I said, "Is he in Seattle?" And she said, "Oh, no, he's in your area code. They do it all by computer." My son was living a mile and a half away from me 27 years after I gave him up. And anyway, I called him. She said, "Can I give him your number?" I said, "No." I said, "Call him back. Tell him I'm really happy. Give me his. Tell him I'll call him when I've collected myself." I called my sponsor, who was home, thank God. I called my parents, who are not home, thank God. I called a couple of friends, including Harvey, who had adopted children. I called a couple of other friends. I said a prayer. I picked up the phone. I introduced myself, and I said, "I understand you've been looking for me." In our first conversation, he told me he'd been in a rehab. I figured, what the hell? I told him I'd been in AA for 21 years. He wasn't sober, so I now picture him sitting on the other end of the line going, "Oh, shit. Oh, shit, she knows, you know." Anyway, I met him 2 days later. Some of you know him. He's a 6'3", half-Mexican male version of me. He looks exactly like me, except he's 6'3", half-Mexican and a guy. It was really tough at first. I didn't like him very much. He was a practicing alcoholic. My parents wanted nothing to do with it. And you know what? I just left everybody alone to do what they wanted to do. I left him alone to drink, although I had a relationship with him. I left my parents alone to do whatever it was that they needed to do. And on July 11th of 1997, a year and a week to the day that he found me, my son got sober. And now he has 14 months of sobriety. And I stay out of his business. I don't know his sponsor. I didn't ask him to pass him by me for approval. On March of this year, on my 23rd birthday, my parents and my son came to my home group, the Sunday Morning Robertson Originals, and they all gave me a cake and met for the first time. My parents had lunch with my son on Saturday without me. And it was a huge secret in the 60s. You didn't tell people when you were a pregnant young girl like me in the 60s. My mother has come full circle, and she is now carrying pictures, showing pictures to her friend and telling them about her grandson. And it's been the most amazing experience of my life. And the thing for which I am most grateful is the person that I became in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think when he found me, he scored. Not only did he score because he found me, he scored because I am well-respected, well-known, active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had many fine men to introduce him to after he got here. I then left him alone, but I had a lot of people, and a lot of my friends have taken a real interest in my son. And, you know, I got to tell you, I've had people come up to me after I've told this story and say, you know, I found my mother, and she's drinking, and it's really awful. But, you know, for me, the scenario couldn't be better. I've met his parents. They love me. They think I'm a good influence in his life. They know that I'm not trying to take over. And it has been remarkable, and it's still unfolding. You know, it's still unfolding. And, you know, to say that I'm grateful would be to diminish, you know, my experience here in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are no words to describe, you know, what my life is like here in Alcoholics Anonymous as opposed to what it was that I came from. You know, I'm a woman today. And I respect myself, and I respect you. And I am so grateful to have had this opportunity to speak here tonight, and I want to thank you all very much for having me.